Tonight I wanted to talk a little bit about the heroes and villains in my life and how they formed and informed the characters in my book. And I'll start by saying that my first hero, yes, who was it? My father, of course. And my second hero then was my brother, my older brother. And he remained my hero for approximately 4 years. From the time I was born until I was 4 years old, and one day in the basement he said to me, his bedroom was right next to the kitchen in our home. And there was a door that led from his bedroom into the kitchen. And my mother used to go to the bakery and get maple bars, very fresh, very good maple bars. And he used to go in at night and appropriate a few and have them in his bedroom. And of course, he would share them with me. So one afternoon, my hero brother, who could do everything, and I wasn't allowed to do any of those things he could do because he was a boy, I was in the basement, and there was like this shadow over near the laundry tub, and it was my brother, and he said, "Come over here, quick, come over here." And I said, "What?" He said, "Look what I've got." And he holds out this wonderful looking maple bar. It was just beautiful. He said, "Come on, come on, take a bite." So, of course, I did. And I took a bite, and it was a Fell's Naphtha bar. Do you know what that is? It's an awful kind of soap.
Sure.
Just an awful kind of soap. So he was never more my hero. I love him dearly, but he's never more my hero. Then my heroes and villains started really forming. And the villains seemed to all wear black. And they had wimples, if you know what a wimple is. A little white thing that nuns wear. Yes. Well, I spent most of my childhood with villains thinking they were in control. Nuns who loved to break yardsticks over my arm, who loved to put me in the cloakroom and close the door and leave me there. And we're at about second grade at this point. But it went on and on and on. And on into college, where still the villain wore black, and a Jesuit priest slapped me in logic class at Seattle University, whereupon I quit school there and went to Mexico to go to school and learned about a lot of sort of exotic plants, I might say. I have to, I guess, watch my mouth here. A lot of exotic Mexican plants. Then, very oddly, my heroes turned from black to white. You know, when you see the good guy, he's always wearing a white hat, white cowboy hat, and the bad guy's always wearing the black. Well, mine changed because shortly after I got out of college, the Ku Klux Klan burned my house down. And, of course, they wore white. My hero was a cop. A southern cop in Temple, Georgia, and his name was J.M. Rutledge. And J.M. came on, he was the only cop in town in Temple, Georgia. He came on at sunset, he got off at sunrise, and he was the law, right? And he was everything you would ever imagine a southern cop to be, the way he looked and so on. And when we met, I was just starting to write about the problems with poverty in the Deep South. I was very naive. I knew nothing, about what was going on, except that I was very concerned that there was a lot of poverty there. And I got involved with a program, and they sort of said, "Okay, you live in Carroll County, Georgia. They have no health care for poor people. They have no daycare for poor people's kids." So working with some other people, I started a health clinic and a daycare center. And they were just by, you know, by the facts of life, they were integrated. There were both white poor people and black poor people. But that wasn't allowed at that time. So these were the first integrated facilities in the county. The daycare center was at a Catholic missionary church. And a wonderful, this guy was a good guy now. He wore black. He was a priest from Ireland. He was a missionary priest in the south of the U.S. And the daycare center and the church it was attached to were built by Susan Hayward, the actress. And I know you're looking blank at me. You've probably never heard of Susan Hayward. Her hair is exactly the color of yours. Was. Exactly. Susan Hayward lived across the road from this little missionary church, and she had, because you know, she had to go to church every Sunday, she was a Catholic, she had a really beautiful church built and this facility, which we used as a daycare center. So after my house was burned down, which was interesting because I apparently slept through the cross burning, which was the night before, they came and burned a cross on my lawn. And I didn't even notice it. I didn't know. I slept through it. And then I went out of town for a couple of days. And when I came back, I was looking for my house, driving up the road. And it wasn't there. And I started to think, jeez, I've only been gone 2 days. Is my memory that bad? Where is it? And then I saw this big square of ashes. And so I learned from my hero, who's wearing black, J.M. Rutledge, the cop, that he and his sidekick, who's this guy who was mentally challenged named Pope, had come by the previous night and put out the cross fire and didn't tell me because they didn't want to worry me. So then the next night, the Klan came back and burned the entire house to the ground. So then I came home and I discovered it. And so J.M., then to me, he was a kind of hero because he was obviously taking a stand, a really important stand, because it developed that I was charged with sedition by the county government, meaning that I was attempting to overthrow the government. Go figure, overthrowing the government of a rural southern county. So there was this big hearing. And all these people came, and the mayor and the city council of Temple, Georgia, this little town, came, and J.M. Rutledge was there, and Father Burke the priest, and Susan Hayward did not come, but she sent a representative, and I still have this on tape, this meeting, where I was being held up as, you know, somebody who's trying to bring down the government. And here, you know, here are all the powers of the county. And when it came time for this cop to speak, he got up and he exposed the mayor and all the city councilmen as Klan members. They were that night just relieved of their positions. And it was that then they had evidence that J.M. had gathered that they had set fire to my house. And so I thought, wow, you know, this is really great. This is a happy ending. Well, about 2 weeks later, I woke up one night. I had a roommate, a woman from California, who was a VISTA volunteer, and she shared a house with me, and it was an old mill house where a lot of people lived, you know, together. So there were like three doors in front and three doors in back, and I woke up and I heard this pounding going on, and you know, so I turned to Margaret and said, Margaret, wake up, you know, and she wouldn't wake up, and then I realized the gas was on. And Margie was unconscious. And now Margie was about 5'10" and pretty big. And then I looked out a window and I saw these guys with the butts of their shotguns pounding on the doors, trying to knock the doors down. So I had Margie, who was virtually unconscious. I mean, she was kind of you know, talking a little bit, but not clearly. And I dragged her out one of the back doors and put her in this little Volkswagen Bug that I had. And I had to shoot past these guys on the driveway. So I did, and I just shot past them. And I did not stop driving until I got to Atlanta. And the next day, the FBI came down, and they said, you know, we're pulling this Vista volunteer out. We're pulling you out. Nobody's going to go in there again. This is too dangerous. This is too dangerous. And, you know, Margie got better. She was fine. And, you know, we both just said, hey, you know, we're here. We're, you know, I was writing about what was happening in this county. And, you know, and we said, we're not leaving. You know, for us to leave would be a really it would be a defeat. And so we refused to leave. The FBI said, you're on your own, folks, you know, and left. So we were there, and then I got a call from Susan Hayward saying, you must come to my house immediately. So I drove across the county, and I went to her house, and I mean, those of you who know who Susan Hayward was, she was an incredibly beautiful and very wild woman. And I walked into her house, and here we are in rural Georgia, and there are all these Picassos on the wall, you know. And I'm sitting there thinking, what am I doing here? What's going on? And suddenly, I was, her representative said, come outside. So I went out to the back, and here appears Susan Hayward in her riding breeches and, you know, looking like she's going on set. The wild red hair, and she's got this shotgun. She says, come here. And so I went over there, and she said, now look, I'm going to show you how to do this. And so she just basically gave me instructions on how to shoot a gun. And we got along really well, and I hit the target every time, and I'm left-handed, so she was very pleased. And so then, I think I'm sort of staying too long on this particular subject, but J.M. Rutledge is a real hero of mine. Because, you know, Mr. G.M. Ford is a writer who's looking for me, I think. Anyway, no. So then, J.M. Rutledge, the cop, came to my house one day. I was still living there. I refused to give up. So did my phone. And he said, tonight, the reveners are coming. You know, what do they call them? Alcohol, tobacco, firearms people. They're coming. The reveners, as they knew them in Georgia, are coming, and they're going to bust the still. And he said, you want to come along and watch? And I said, Jim, how can you do that? How can you bust a still, illegal liquor being made in, you know, in the woods? How can you bust a still? You know, it's probably a friend of yours. And he said, yeah, he is a friend of mine. And I said, well, he's probably supporting his family on this, you know. Yeah. I said, I don't believe that you're going to do this. And he said, well, why don't you just come along with me and see it? And I said, oh, my God, this man, who, you know, has his own set of rules. And so I had to go. I just had to go.
No,
they hung up anyway. So I went in the car. It was very late at night. It was about 11 o'clock, if I recall. I got in the patrol car with JM, and we drove out into the piney woods of Georgia. And behind us was this black, unmarked car of the Reveners, the ATF people. And these guys got out of their car, and JM got out, and he said, you stay here. And I said, I don't believe this. And I'm so furious with him. I said, you know, you could just say no right now. You could say, oh, my God, I made a mistake. Nope, we're doing this. Got to do this. It's the law. So he leads the Reveners into the woods. I sat there, and a while later, all of a sudden, there was an explosion in the woods. I mean, I could see through the trees and see the explosion. And then about a half an hour later, all these guys came back. You know, the Reveners were wearing, this was like in the 60s, the Reveners were wearing like those little skinny black ties and the black, you know, suit jackets, and they're in the woods, right? And they all came out, and they were carrying jugs, gallons, you know, those plastic gallon jugs of white lightning. And they loaded them in their car, And then J.M. had a couple himself, and he loaded them in the back of the patrol car, and the revenues went away, and we sat there. I said, you know, J.M., you have been a hero of mine. You've been, like, one of the most, you know, brave, courageous people I've ever met in my life. And you do this. Why? And he said, just wait a couple minutes. So the revenues went away, and then he drove me along another path through the woods the car could go through. And there was the real still. And he had built a fake still with the guy who had the still. And they had blown up the fake still to get rid of the revenuers. But he remains my hero. I'm sorry, I went on very long with that. My next, and I will finish with this, my next heroes were villains, well, I told you the KKK. My next heroes were Chinese coal miners who took me into their coal mine 1 mile down and 5 miles in during the Cultural Revolution. And I was fairly naive at this point, fairly young. I had been invited over as an artist, and I had to leave the U.S. to get over there. The country was in terror. Nobody dared speak. It was horrifically scary. And it was so scary, in fact, that I was performing. I used to make my living as a singer and songwriter. And I was performing and in Beijing. And I had my guitar case, and I had one of those little bubble wrap things on top of the strings, you know. And it just was in the way. And I think I bought some fabric or something, and I put that in there. And I put the bubble wrap in a trash can in a hotel room. So, like, a week or 10 days later, I arrived by train up in northern China at this coal mining town, Tangshan. Get off the train, there's this little person in a mouse suit standing there holding my bubble wrap. That is how in control the government was at that time. They did not allow one piece of anything from a foreigner to go into society, into their population. So the guy, you know, gave me that and I got all right. I went into the mine. While I was in the mine, there was a little cave-in, and it was right behind where I was, and there was a coal miner beside me, and I noticed that he was terrified, more terrified than I was, and I was pretty scared. So it stopped, and we got back up, and I convinced this guy, who could speak a little English, to let me have a secret meeting, not known to the officials, with a few of the coal miners. So he took me to this place that night, and these coal miners were there, and we started talking, and I said, the first thing I'm going to tell you is, I've looked at your hands, and I do not believe you are coal miners. And it turned out that these men in this coal mine in Tangshan were all of China's Western classical composers who had been sent to the mines because they were composing classical music, Western classical music. And so we had this wonderful discussion that night, and I asked them, you know, how do you, are you still composing? Oh, yes, they said, we're still composing. And we're terrified when we go in the mines. We know nothing about mining. You know, we're just, you know, like you down there. We're still composing. And I said, well, how do you remember it? And they said, we have to keep it in our heads. We cannot write it down, or something worse will happen to us. And those men were so amazing. And I later got to hear some of their music, and it was fantastic. And it was very limited. I just heard a little, but it was wonderful. And I came home from China, and about 7 months later, Tangshan had an earthquake, and all those miners were killed. So China lost in one fell swoop all its Western classical composers. At that moment, it was amazing. And those are my heroes. those kind of people. And I could go on. I was going to go on to the Soviet Union and their coal mines, but I won't. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wow.
This is so extraordinary. And the villains are so evil. I'm wondering how that extreme range of goodness and evil inform your writing.
These are the people who really have inspired me in my writing. Both the villains and the heroes. And it's inspired me on many different levels. My time spent living in the South has given me a real sense of the people in the South who have been very courageous. And in times of, you know, racial turmoil, in times of anti-war, and then in the racial turmoil, which still goes on, mixed in with that. It seems to me when I write about, and right now I'm working on a novel that is based in New Orleans, and when I write about Southerners, it's like channeling these voices. I hear the voices of these people who I either, you know, think of as my heroes or remember as villains. And so their voices are always with me. My first book of nonfiction, Hillbilly Women, you know, I have the voices of these women in Southern Appalachia constantly with me, constantly telling their life stories and how they survived, you know, the worst conditions in the United States in terms of poverty and unemployment and, you know, health conditions and so on. So they're always in my head. And I think that I could probably, in the novel I'm working on now, which is my eighth novel, my tenth book, I think I could say that I could identify aspects of my protagonist and my antagonist who come from these people I've met and who have informed my life in, you know, in my adult experience.
So would you say that Venus Diamond is sort of the best qualities, represents the best qualities of your heroes, and like the murder in this book, I just read The Fly.
So you didn't read the last page?
No.
Okay, good.
It was really...
Not fair!
Kills off. According to Flyleaf, he's killed off 8 people, and he just has...
Did The Flyleaf say that? They kill off 8 people?
Well, something like that. Also,
it's a terrible picture of a person who is totally amoral.
Yeah. This book is about diamond smuggling. And it's about the smuggling of diamonds from South and Western Africa from the blood diamond mines where the rebels and corrupt governments who are running certain mines in Southern and Western Africa, and these mines are worked by slave labor, other tribes that they have enslaved to work the mines. The diamonds are then traded for weapons, which are used to kill people. Therefore, they are known as blood diamonds or war diamonds. Now, Canada, in the early 90s, discovered diamonds, and they're now the third biggest diamond country in the world. Interestingly, a 23-year-old woman just graduating from her geology, getting her geology degree, discovered the first kimberlite diamond pipe in Canada. She's now a billionaire, but anyway.
Yes, 8 men are dead, and 1 woman is missing from one of Canada's prestigious diamond mines.
Right.
It doesn't say, but the woman presumed to be hostage to one of the world's priceless diamonds has disappeared. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say that one person killed him. Maybe it was this story from the paper here.
It might be.
That talked about the killer.
Well, the...
The ruthless killer methodically eliminates the people helping him steal, smuggle, cut, and sell the most valuable diamond in the world. but a bad, evil person.
Yes. Well, the point being that these diamonds that are taken out of, and we talked about this,
mm-hmm.
that are taken out of Africa are smuggled into Canada in the rough. Right? In the rough. When they arrive in Canada, they're polished. And they get the little laser polar bear or iceberg or whatever the company has, and they're sold as the good diamonds. Because Canada is very proud of the fact that they have no blood on their diamonds. However, the point being here that unless you can trace your diamond back to the source, you don't know whether or not it really is a blood diamond. The weapons they trade are from the Ukraine. When the Soviet Union fell, the Ukraine... There's a big scramble for all the military weapons and so on, and they're on the black market now. And there's a guy named Victor Bout, who's in Russia, he's a Russian, who runs the whole system called the Tube. And this is where all the smuggling of diamonds and arms go. And Venus, who was previously tracking poachers of endangered species, knows that it's the same Tube that animal endangered species are smuggled on. So they bring her in to track down who these people are who are selling diamonds for weapons.
Oh, that's really great.
Yeah, it's a very different scenario. Very different. And I had fun with it. But I'd rather be in Paris. What can I say?
How do you pick up your subjects? The themes for your books from
they
your
just come out of my head, you know.
Why the diamonds, for instance?
You know, I had been reading about war diamonds and blood diamonds for a long time, and I started thinking, you know, there's something here that's just something's not right. And I had been writing about this tube where endangered species, parts of endangered species or live ones, were being smuggled. And I had learned already over, what, seven books, or six books, that also drugs were being smuggled along there, and that humans were being smuggled along there, and weapons. So I said to myself, I wonder if diamonds are being smuggled along there. So I started talking to diamond brokers, and they would literally back away when I would try to ask them questions. Literally back away. And they were, you could see that they were scared. Because they knew something that they did not want to talk about and they weren't supposed to talk about. And by the way, the biggest diamond stash in the world is near Charterhouse Square in London. It's that Charterhouse, which holds the De Beers backlog of diamonds that they keep so they can keep the market price high. And when one of their competitors puts out a certain shape of diamond, or a certain, you know, color of diamond, they then flood the market to bring their competitor's price down, and then they pull it all back in again. Price shoots up, and they sell them. It's an amazing system.
It's a cartel.
Yeah, it's a cartel. It has never, you know, De Beers claims that it's no longer a cartel, but it is, and it's incredibly powerful, and it's so well. After the book came out. I was in Paris, in fact, when I got this. I got an email from a friend of mine who had access to, he was a security guy, and he had access to the CIA memos. And this memo that he sent me showed that Osama bin Laden, who could no longer use cash to buy arms because the cash was being traced, was trading diamonds for weapons, and that he had already traded over $3 billion in diamonds for weapons. So, I just was intuiting this, but it turned out it was very factual that it went to that level.
Scary.
Yeah. But it's exciting too. It gets your adrenaline up.
Yeah,
you know.
Sure.
So anyway, thank you for coming. I guess I am really in competition with the... It's not the Red... It's Houston and...
St. Louis.
St. Louis. You know?
Probably over
and
now.
I missed last night's game.
If you do a second show.
I could do a... You know, yeah. Second show.
You can go back to Paris, man.
I would rather go back to Paris.
Are you
Do you know Leclerc?
Yes, sure.
Yes. Do you know Leo the Lion? The restaurant there, little cafe, Leo the Lion?
No.
You not to go there. Yeah, yeah.
But it's good.
I mean, well, of course, everything in Paris is good. But that one particular place.
That's where you stayed, Rue Claire, or no?
Just off Rue Claire, Champs de Mars.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
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 Just to play there as a kid at first.
Really?
So you had a good weather?
We had beautiful weather. It was very hot. It was in summer.
Oh, yeah.
What about warming? We had our day planned. We went out in the morning. We went to our favorite little cafe on Rue Claire. And we bought our coffee and our croissants and so on. And then we went across to get our baguette. And then we went to the fromagerie and we picked out the cheese and we got the wine. And we took that home and left it in the fridge. And then we went out and about. And when it got very hot, we came, at lunch, high noon, we came back to our hotel, had our wonderful lunch, had a nap, and then got up when it was cool and went out again. But the best part of this was Jerry, my husband, walked into the boulangerie the first morning, and he walked up to the woman behind the counter and he said, "Au revoir."
Well,
look at him.
Yeah, I can understand.
Bye.
That's what he meant. Au revoir.
And so every morning when we would go there, she said, "Au revoir." Yeah.
You have to practice your French.
Right? Yeah, just, well, no, it wasn't me. Anyway, it was a really wonderful trip. It was our honeymoon. What can I say?
Did Jerry loved it too?
Oh, yeah. We did not want to leave. We're going back.
We're going to go back in May.
Well, we were 10 days only. But you're going back in May?
Surviving,
yeah. My brother and his wife lived in that same neighborhood, the Rue Claire neighborhood, for 2 years. Their children went to school there, and it's amazing how quickly they picked up.
Oh, yeah, kids picked up languages very fast.
Yeah, their brains. Did you know, by the way, about brains? Did you read that special article, where was it, in the New York Times about brain development? This might make you feel really good. If I had known it when I was in my teens and my 20s, I would have felt good. It turns out, this was an article in the New York Times about the death penalty and kids getting the death penalty for committing murders. Well, it turns out that the American Psychiatric Association has, the testing has been done, and they have said that the human brain is not finished developing until the mid or late 20s. Therefore, when we are in our teens and our brains are still developing, and in our 20s and our brains are still developing, we don't have as much, because it's the frontal lobe that's the last to develop, we don't have as much impulse control and we don't have as much good judgment as people whose brains have finished developing. And I'm just tuck that in your back pocket and keep it in mind. If you're ever feeling like things are crazy in the world, remember that your brain is still struggling with it.
The logical extension of that, Sky, is that you could only be convicted of murder and executed if you were 25. Because once you've gone over that peak, then your powers decline.
Right.
And so once again, you cannot be held responsible.
I like that. But this is really true. And if I had known that's what was going on in my, crazed state as a teenager, I think I would have felt a lot better. I would have felt, I would have felt like I'm not just going totally nuts, but something's going on up here that, is really physiological.
So did they overrule?
No, it's just they're presenting it now as an argument against giving the death penalty to 17-year-olds because there's now quite some case that's before, I don't know if it's before the Supreme Court. Is it? Yeah. About a 17-year-old being executed for murder. So. So guys, you probably want to close your store, don't you?
No.
I mean, I got to...
Here's something who's just come for your reading, so...
I just came to see, listen to what we're doing.
Oh my God, can you play it back?
Yeah, sure, I can listen to it.
Oh boy.
Well, how do the DeBushes and the DeBeers...
The DeBushes and the DeBeers?
The DeBeers mutually benefit from this.
Okay. I do not think this is the DeBushes and the DeBeers,
okay.
But I do believe that this is, the black market in this world is as powerful as many of the most powerful governments in this world. It is extremely powerful. And going back to, I wrote a book about the Soviet Union, and going back after the split, it was clear. It was exactly the same, except there were better restaurants, and you could get drugs if you wanted. You could get coffee. Oh my God, you couldn't get coffee in the Soviet Union. But who was in control? The mob. The Russian mob was in control, not the Soviets, the Russian mob. Everything the same. And that's why you see some Russian people having it. Lots of them having demonstrations, let's go back to Soviet control. At least we got bread. Under the Soviets, the bread trucks are, guarded by armed guards. The bread is delivered. You get it. You get your share. Under mob rule, you don't know what you're going to get. And there's no, it's pretty much chaos. And Putin is now, attempting to deal with that chaos. And he's discovering that probably people in Russia are more used to being in a non-democratic society that provides them with things than they are in a democratic society where they have to struggle. And especially, it's not like us struggling. They've got the mob to deal with now, in a big way, not the way we deal with the mob. But that that power, this guy Viktor Bout, for example, he's been, everybody has tried to bust him. And he's so clever. And this guy's a billionaire, Russian, who fingered all the major weapons in all the republics as they broke up from the Soviet Union. And, he could supply a major army. And I'm sure he has. He supplied armies around the world. They figure in the sense that I would not be surprised, because Viktor Bout sells to all sides. I would not be surprised if Viktor Bout is providing weapons to Osama bin Laden, and the CIA said, of course, that 3.4 billion, I think it was, weapons had come through diamond smuggling to Osama bin Laden. That's Viktor Bout. Anything to do with diamonds and East European weapons is Viktor Bout. And so on the U.S. side, the administration now, they're not as connected as, Bush Sr. and Halliburton and all those folks and the bin Ladens. But they're facing their opponent, a power struggle is going on with Viktor Bout and his people, who are providing weapons for the other side. So, it's all up there at the top. It's all up there where we don't have, a prayer of controlling it on that level. I don't know what you think, but I think that this election is absolutely crucial, whether or not we have, the delegate system. I think that the popular vote is extremely important. Extremely important. You guys, you can't vote yet, can you?
No.
But, yes. Next time you'll be able to. How old is it in New York and Washington State?
It's 18.
It is 18, you can vote for president?
Yeah.
I'm 15, so no.
At 18 you can?
Yeah.
That's great. some way and shows it in its own way. And I am incredibly inspired by people in their teens and 20s now who have a sense of what's going on in the world. Really good sense of what's going on. Very, very accurate sense. Because they're not jaded, you know, and they never, they don't have that fog to look through. They just see directly what's going on and they just call it as it is. And there's idealism in those generations right there. How many people lose that idealism when they get into their 30s and 40s and so on? They lose it and they say, well, you know, it's no use, you know, it's just, and get cynical. You know, what can I do? If you lose your spirit, you can't do anything. And I really think that the future of this world depends on the generations who have not yet lost their idealism. You know, and those of us who also haven't, who haven't given up on it. But I think that every generation has its leaders, and those leaders need to do better than the generation before them. And they, you know, and I think that's going to happen in the world. In the world, I just see amazing communication among younger people in this world who can't even speak the same language, and they have so much in common, and they're so informed about what's going on, and they have so much at stake. You know? Yeah, they're not. They're planets.